Accession number 28637, Reel 3.
Mrs. Alison Selford, Reel 3. Going back to your work on the farms, you know, in Somerset, this was, you know, setting up the union. Did you gain any impression of the farmers, and were they being exploitative?
Oh, yes, they were. In Somerset, they're mostly small farmers, and during the agricultural depression before the outbreak of war, of course, they'd been living on the edge of bankruptcy. Naturally, they were not disposed to be generous or kind to their employees, but the employees had a worse time than the farmers did by a long way. And another thing I don't regret, although I do regret many things in my life, I do not regret that I learned how other people lived. My childhood had been very comfortable, and I'd had everything my devoted parents could give me, and I had not learned how awful life was for the vast majority of people in those days. If you think what a working man's life was like, and a working woman's still worse, before there were washing machines, before there were fridges, when good weather meant the milk went off faster, and bad weather was sheer torture because there wasn't, you could only afford to heat one room in the house. And all these were things that all working people took for granted, but the agricultural workers had it even worse. And this was not a bad thing for me to find out.
So really, you must have gained satisfaction from what you did. Contribution you made towards a better life.
Indeed. And all the time I was engaged in this work, I was getting reams of Marxist advice from my mentor, Jack Selford, whose then girlfriend was extremely jealous of the time he devoted to writing to me. His then girlfriend was quite a nice girl whom I had known in the Labour League of Youth at Southend, one of the dedicated communists who came in to take it over. She was, I think, a couple of years older than me, not more. And I was quite fond of her. And I didn't have any designs on him in those days because, in my opinion, which I think was right, he was still far too much in love with his wife to treat any girl decently. It was a very tragic situation. Well, she died in 1940. She died she died from having an abortion. Nothing to do with the chap she had run off with. She'd gone through a lot of other lovers by then. I only ever saw her once. She looked a poor, sad, lost creature, but evidently the chap still found her very attractive.
How easy was it for you to get out of the Land Army? You know,
that was all right, and the Land Army was glad to see me go, I think. I don't remember having any difficulty there. There was conscription of women, but that came in very gradually. And I switched over to the civil defence, so it was another patriotic job, you see. And there was certainly no difficulty about getting into the Bristol civil defence. Bristol had by then been bombed as seven times. We are talking now about May 1941.
But still, it's interesting because you're doing this war work,
yeah.
And yet the Communist Party was against the war because it was an imperialistic war.
Oh, yes. But you see, the Communist Party had a certain amount of common sense. And its number one rule, you go where the workers are. You do not separate yourself from the workers. So there were no communist conscientious objectors because that separated people from the workers and the workers wouldn't listen to what they said. No, the Communist Party did have that much common sense. The Communist Party was absolutely against people making themselves conspicuous in any way that was going to divide them from the working masses. And so there was no difficulty about that. The whole idea of being a conscientious objector, which was sort of, to our eyes, was a sort of conceit and cutting yourself off from people. And we had nothing to do with it. No, if the workers were in the army, you joined the army. So, anyway, by this time, my mentor, Jack Selford, was being called up. And he was called up. He was still writing me long letters explaining the party line, sometimes on lines the party itself hadn't thought of. But still, he was a thinker, you see.
So,
and I was always falling in love with wildly unsuitable people. I can't tell you what awful times I had love-wise. And
but if I could ask you about the work you were doing with in Bristol...
The
civil defence. Could you tell me about that?
Well, I joined, as I say, when Bristol had just been bombed seven times. I was not to know that the blitzes were over. It was, of course, very lucky for me that they were, but I didn't know that. And they were welcoming people with open arms. Anybody who would join was welcome. So I... it was quite different from the Land Army, of course, apart when there was a great deal of training to do, first aid and that sort of thing. But when we weren't training, we did get a rest, and I was able to catch up on my reading, which was nice. And we had, to everybody's surprise, we had a month of total peace and quiet. Nobody knew why. We rapidly discovered what the peace and quiet meant because the Germans attacked Russia. They'd taken all their planes over to the Eastern Front. Well, then Churchill made a speech that night, which was broadcast. And Churchill's speech was an act of great political courage because a great many people in the Conservative Party said, let them, leave them to it, let them fight it out. We ought to be out of this war if it's between Germany and Russia. Churchill wouldn't have it. He said he was not going to unsay any word he had said against Bolshevism. I can remember every word of this speech as if it was yesterday. We were all sitting in the civil defence listening to every word of this which was broadcast to us. And he said he was not going to unsay any word he had ever said against Bolshevism, but he was on the side of Russia against Germany. And we all sat back because there had been a very real possibility he wouldn't take the line or not take it so forcefully. And I remember one old labourer saying, "Thank you, Mr. Churchill." This was, and my feelings about the speech were generally shared. So, all right. From then on, the Communist Party was super patriots, which of course exposed them to a great deal of ridicule, but came in handy all the same for the government. We'd do anything we were asked to do. And as I say, we had this adjoining the civil defence was a mistake from the point of view of having anything to do, but it was wonderful from the point of view of catching up on my reading, and I read lots and lots of books I'd never had time to read before. And had a good deal of training. But the only thing that actually happened was the Bath Blitz. The Bath Blitz was in April 42. I think I'm right about it. It was spring, and it was beautiful spring weather. And Bath, we in the Bristol Civil Defence were sent along, obviously, the 12 miles to help Bath. There was only 12 miles between those two towns, but what a difference in outlook. The Bath Civil Defence had always thought this couldn't happen to them. There were all sorts of legends, for example, that Mussolini wouldn't have Bath bombed because he was so keen on the Roman remains, and that the Germans wouldn't have bombed Bath because it had air pockets above it, which kept planes from diving, or something like that. And these things were then generally believed, and it was a complete shock and surprise when Bath really got bombed. Well, when the Bristol Civil Defence was called in, we all had to stop and wait for our proper orders in a proper military manner at a village called Newton St. Low outside Bath, and this was the village which I had, where I had been organising the workers, so it was a farm worker, so it was very well known to me. And the village had a good view of Bath, and we could see the whole city in flames ahead of us. However, when we got the order, we went on into the midst of the flames, and there was a fried fish shop in the middle of Bath, which had been kept by a communist family, and this fried fish shop was a great rendezvous for communists. Well, this was one of the first to get hit, and that was the first time I ever saw a dead body. There was some passerby had been hit by the bomb. The Bath people had rather good shelters, not that they had been built as shelters. They were the basements of the Bath buildings. Bath houses were built with very strong basements because of the slope of the hill. If they hadn't had these enormous basements, most of those famous crescents would long since have slid down into the valley. So people had indeed lots of shelters. But in the middle of Bath, there were a lot of evacuated families from London, and Bath was full of children, and this was terrible for the rescue men. They were used to carrying dead bodies, but they were in tears because of these children, dead children they were carrying.
What were you doing?
Was I doing? Well, very little. I was waiting to be told what to do. We all went to after I'd seen the dead body outside the fish shop, my job wasn't picking up dead bodies. My job was looking for live people who needed first aid. You see. Anyway, I was an ambulance attendant, so the driver of the ambulance and myself and we were directed to go and wait for further orders at the Bath ARP headquarters. While we were there, the bombers came back, and you see the Germans would set a town on fire first and then send in the heavy bombers when the fires had got a hold and made the place a good easy target to see. They would send the heavy bombers in, and we were in time for the wave of heavy bombers who came in. Nobody was giving us any orders, which puzzled us very much. We were supposed to be taking our orders from the Bath Civil Defence, and as we waited for orders, the heavy bombers came back, and we all with one accord dived under the nearest solid thing, which happened to be a billiard table. And I was under this billiard table, and some flying piece of masonry hit me in the bottom, and a little small thin girl came crawling out from beneath me and said, "Oh, Alison, I'll never say you're too fat again." Get the blast off her. And when we had picked ourselves up and dusted ourselves off, we were very surprised. Where was this Bath Civil Defence who was supposed to give us orders? And we never heard a cheep out of them. And came the dawn and the all clear. And the dawn didn't come very soon because this was just about the spring equinox. Dawn was only a little before 6, as I remember. And we all came out to look at what was going on. And as the all clear notes died away, out of the basement, which we hadn't even known was there, came these Bath Civil Defence people who should have been giving us orders. It turned out their morale had totally collapsed. This was one of the things which were not publicly mentioned at the time. They had completely lost track of what they were supposed to be doing and had only thought about saving their own skins. Consequently, we, the Bristol lot, including myself, had been left to face the bombs while these people who should have been giving us orders took shelter. And we were... As the dawn came, which I hadn't thought I would be alive to see, we looked at these deplorable characters from the Bath Civil Defence. It turned out that some rescue work had been going on in the city because one of the Bristol people had decided the Bath He wasn't going to get any orders from the Bath people and had started giving orders himself and had taken over. But it was one of those deplorable episodes when I'm afraid the British were not so splendid as we afterwards made ourselves out to be.
I must just check your microphone because I think I can't see it. And I think it must have fallen. There we are. We're still getting some sound. But why don't you lean back comfortably like you were before?
Oh,
there
yes. Why don't I lean better. Back comfortably?
That's better. And yes. Then I can see your microphone.
Yes.
That's lovely. So how long were you in the Bristol Defence?
Oh, well, now, what happened about that? We were all... Oh, conscription had got serious by that time. I mean, conscription of women was not serious before then.
So you would say it got serious about 42, would you?
Yes, about 42, yes. And they started looking at women under 25 in the civil defence, and as it was only occasional episodes like the Bath Blitz that were happening... The raid on Bath was one of the Baedeker raids. You remember that they were called the Baedeker raids because the Germans bombed small towns famous for their beauty and, of course, lacking any effective defence. And one of them was Bath, one was Exeter, one was Norwich, I think. And I can't remember the others. I know it was Bath, Exeter and Norwich. I know Exeter is the most awful mess now because it wasn't rebuilt as it was at all. Bath was rather carefully rebuilt. The beautiful squares and crescents were rebuilt. And...
But you were saying now conscription was serious.
Oh, yes. So well, they looked at women under 25 and decided they shouldn't be in the civil defence. There were only these Baedeker raids, and then there was a long period of nothing. Oh, yes. There was one very small episode in a general history of the war. It wouldn't rate not even as much as a footnote. A passing German bomber dropped one bomb in daylight on the middle of Bristol. And this was, it hit a bus. And the bus caught flames. And I remember being on the scene after the flames had been put out. And the bus was full of the charred bodies of the people who had been burned to death, who looked like wooden dummies. They had been killed before they could make them. They could even attempt to escape. And the men who had been... And the firemen were using their hoses to hose the blood off the pavements. The blood, of course, hadn't come from the burning buses. The blood had come from a woman who had been blown to the top of a lamppost. And before they could get the body down, they had to cut through coils and coils of gut. And the rescue men were telling me all this. I arrived on the scene just afterwards. I do remember that. And the... when people tell me I am talking too lightly of war, I think of scenes like that. And I realise I am not talking lightly of war at all, but I do think we had to go through all that in order to defeat Nazism. And it was worthwhile in the end, though... At least it was worthwhile for the survivors. Of course, the people burned to death on the bus were not asked their opinion. But still, most people supported the war. The people who didn't like the Jehovah's Witnesses who came round to the came round recruiting were given very, very short shrift by the people on whose doors they knocked.
How about other conscientious objectors? Did you ever meet... I know a lot of people, you know, who were left-wing,
yes,
did become conscientious objectors and did various things, some, you know, refusing to serve the war in any way and others doing humanitarian work.
Oh, that's right. Well, I met some of them afterwards, you see, but at the time we thought very little of them. We thought they were just showing off their intellectual superiority and by getting out of this or attempting to distance themselves from this terrible situation that we were all trapped in.
So after the civil defence, what happened to you then? You know,
I was asked what I would like to do. Would I like to join the women's services? And it was, I went and saw a sort of lady recruiting officer who said, why didn't I join the ATS? Because they could use my knowledge of French and German. Well, of course, my French wasn't anywhere near good enough to be handy for... nobody would have parachuted me into occupied France and expected me to pass myself off as a native, no.
End of Reel 3, Mrs. Yes. Alison Selford. Mrs. Alison Selford, Reel 4.
But anyway, the ATS lady suggested I might, in some humble capacity, be useful for my knowledge of French and German, such as it was. And I said that was all very well, but I had observed that large ladies did not look nice in ATS uniform, and I didn't think I would. And as for the other ladies' services, the women's section of the Royal Navy, they were definitely the Navy only chose ladies who looked absolutely marvellous in the uniform, and I knew I wouldn't qualify. And the... but I didn't fancy the ATS either. So I said, really and truly, I would rather go into industry. So they sent me to a training college where I learned to be a welder. And I became a welder in a shipyard in Bristol. And of course, this was already unionized. So I became a shop steward, and that was absolute bliss. I can't tell you how lovely it was working in the shipyard. I loved every minute of it. Only thing was, I wasn't a very efficient welder. And
was it a very hard job to weld?
No, I tell you why I wasn't good at it. It is not hard work to be a welder. It is, in fact, tailor-made for women. You hold up a shield with one hand to protect your eyes, and through the shield you look at the thing you are welding. And it's exactly like sewing. You see these little details, and you have to get the line of stitches right, as it were. Well, unfortunately, I'm hopeless at sewing. And it is, and my welding used to develop little air holes, which welded seams are not supposed to do, and particularly on ships where they might let in the water. So I wasn't very good as a welder. The charge hand thought poorly of me. And they had a bit of difficulty sacking me because I was a shop steward. Oh, dear. So in the end, I We parted company. They didn't. The firm didn't like me much. We